This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Sarah Vowell often reads her funny and perceptive essays on the public radio program This American Life. She also provided the voice of teen superhero Violet Parr in one of last year's most successful films, The Incredibles. If you know her work, then you know that she's immersed in music and movies. Her first collection of essays was even named after a line in The Godfather, "Take the cannoli." But her latest book draws on her life as a history buff. Assassination Vacation is her obsessive and funny account of her tours of sites that mark the lives and deaths of America's first three presidential victims of assassination, Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley. Here's an excerpt, read by Sarah, from the audiobook edition.
The bright side to researching the first three presidential assassinations is that my interest is optional, a choice. One man who makes cameo appearances in all three stories was not so lucky. Abraham Lincoln's oldest son, Robert Todd Lincoln, was in close proximity to all three murders like some kind of jinxed Zelig of doom. The young man who wept at his father's deathbed in 1865 was only a few feet away when James A. Garfield was shot in a train station in 1881. In 1901, Robert arrived in Buffalo mere moments after William McKinley fell. Robert Todd Lincoln's status as a presidential death magnet weighed on him. Late in life, when he was asked to attend some White House function, he grumbled,
"If only they knew, they wouldn't want me there."
Sarah Vowell, with the final line from Conan O'Brien, from the audiobook edition of her new book, Assassination Vacation. She spent many vacations touring historical sites and devotes a considerable part of her life to reading about history. That's what led to her previous book, The Partly Cloudy Patriot, published in 2002. That's when Terry most recently spoke with Sarah Vowell.
Sarah, you love history, and you write about that in your first essay in your new collection, and this essay finds you at Gettysburg on the 137th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, so you're there for another reading of it. There's a paragraph here I'd like you to read about loving history.
I could say that I've come to Gettysburg as a rubbernecking tourist, that I've shown up to force myself to mull over the consequences of a war I never think about, because that would make a better story. A gum-chewing, youngish person who says like too much comes face to face with the horrors of war and learns something. But, like, this story isn't like that. Fact is, I think about the Civil War all the time, every day. I can't even use a cotton ball to remove my eye makeup without spacing out about slavery's favorite cash crop. And that line from Lincoln's second inaugural address that it may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. Well, that, and why does black eyeliner smudge way more than brown?
Sarah Vowell, reading from The Partly Cloudy Patriot. In your book, you write about how you spoke to a friend of yours about your love for historical places and your emphasis on historical places that have some kind of disaster attached to them.
Uh-huh.
And the friend you talked to about this is somebody who counsels people who survived torture.
Right.
So what did you tell her? What did she tell you?
Well, I called her right after I got back from Salem, and I had a really good time in Salem, but I felt kind of guilty about it. You know, like, one of my favorite things that happened in Salem was that I was at this gift shop, and a guy in the gift shop asked the cashier, "Hey, you got any witchcraft trivets?" And she said, "You mean a trivet with a witch on it?" And I just thought that was really funny, you know, that this guy wanted, you know, that this, I don't know, I mean, it was horrible. This horrible thing happened here and 20 innocent people were executed, but this guy wanted to remember it by buying a thing he could protect his table from a burning saucepan with. And that just cracked me up, but then I felt bad about it. And then I had such a good time in Salem. And I mean, it's a really pretty town and there's a lot to do. And you know, just it's kind of kooky, like the Witch Dungeon Museum and things like that. And And so I got home and I felt guilty because, you know, ultimately this whole town's tourism industry is based around the fact that 20 innocent people were executed. And so I called my friend Kate, and Kate is a psychologist with the program for survivors of torture. And she's one of the funniest people I know, but it's weird that she has this torture job. She talks to people with actual historical problems. So I called her with mine, which was, why do I go to these places and why don't I ever go anywhere fun? Why don't I go to Hawaii or Martha's Vineyard or the Caribbean? Why, you know, like, I went to the homestead of this elderly woman who was executed for witchcraft this weekend and had a great time. What is wrong with me? And, she basically told me, well, she said, it's not denial, it's the opposite of denial. And her idea was that I go to these places and I enjoy them, but that my humor about them is full of, she called it anxious giggles, and that I have an uneasy relationship with American history, which I do, because it's really bloody and dark, besides being inspiring. And that I go to these places and joke around and stuff, and I use humor as a way of managing my anxiety.
How does that strike you?
That seems about right.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I manage my anxiety a lot, I guess.
Our guest is Sarah Vowell, a familiar voice on the public radio program This American Life. Her new book is Assassination Vacation, a one-woman tour of the sites and monuments devoted to Presidents Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley. In 2000, Sarah spoke with Terry about her book, Take the Cannoli. In that book, she wonders why the film The Godfather kidnapped her life, although on the surface it had nothing to do with her. She's a feminist, not Italian. She grew up in small towns and was raised in the Pentecostal faith. Here's a reading from the book.
I am a gunsmith's daughter. I like to call my parents' house, located on a quiet residential street in Bozeman, Montana, the United States of Firearms. Guns were everywhere, the so-called pretty ones like the circa 1850 walnut muzzle loader hanging on the wall, Dad's clients' fixer-uppers leaning into corners, an entire rack right next to the TV. I had to move revolvers out of my way to make room for a bowl of Rice Krispies on the kitchen table. I was 11 when we moved into that Bozeman house. We had never lived in town before, and this was a college town at that. We came from Oklahoma, a dusty little Muskogee County nowhere called Braggs. My parents' property there included an orchard, a horse pasture, and a couple of acres of woods. I knew our lives had changed one morning not long after we moved to Montana when, during breakfast, my father heard a noise and jumped out of his chair. Grabbing a BB gun, he rushed out the front door, and standing in the front yard, he started shooting at crows. My mother sprinted after him, screaming, "Pat, you might ought to check, but I don't think they do that up here." From the look on his face, she might as well have told him that his American citizenship had been revoked. He shook his head, mumbling, "Why, shooting crows is a national pastime, like baseball and apple pie." Personally, I preferred baseball and apple pie. I looked up at those crows flying away and thought, I'm going to like it here.
That's Sarah Vowell reading an essay from Take the Cannoli, Stories from the New World. Now, in a lot of your essays, the fact that you're from Muskogee and then at age 11 moved with your family to Montana comes up a lot. And it's almost as if you think you're from another country than many of your readers. Do you feel that way?
Well, I guess I keep trying to stick up for the flyover land voice, because a lot of people with access to the media are coastal types, and a lot of them are sort of East Coast establishment, went to really good schools kind of people, and I guess I always bring it up because, well, for two reasons, just to say, you know, we exist and we have things to say, but also, I felt like an immigrant as a child moving from a small town, Oklahoma, to a college town. I mean, we did move to Montana, but it was a very college town atmosphere, and that was incredibly foreign to me and also incredibly exciting. So I guess there were
So I have two kind of cultural references there. As a child, we were Pentecostal, and so I guess music was part. Music has always been one of the most important things in my life. And as a child, country music was very important to me. And then when I moved to Montana, that's when I sort of eventually fell in with the kind of 80s indie rock underground, where I guess the people who were important to me were people like the poet Allen Ginsberg, or I was a huge Philip Glass fan as a teenager, things like that. And then when I, right towards the end of high school and the beginning of college, and I stayed in Montana for college, I guess rock and roll kind of took me over, and that was sort of my introduction to fun.
Now, you grew up Pentecostal and went to a Pentecostal church when you lived near Muskogee. What were the services like when you were young?
They were very holy roller. There was a lot of speaking in tongues, and it was pretty fire and brimstone, you know. When we moved to Montana, we went to this kind of non-denominational church, about which my mother said, too much teaching, not enough preaching, because it was definitely in Oklahoma, you were preached to. And yeah, there was a lot of yelling, and there was even finger pointing. You know, the preacher would be in the middle of a sermon, and he would point at, like, he would, I remember once he pointed at this very nice man named Bob Brewster and said, "You're still smoking, Bob Brewster." And, I was just scared to death that I would ever do anything wrong and get, you know, yelled at in church with that finger pointing at me. And then, the one thing that was great about it was music. I mean, we sang all those old hymns, you know, like, I guess I'll Fly Away was my favorite one. And, they're very musical, people. So that was a definite saving grace.
I remember when I interviewed the writer Walter Kern, who was brought up as a Mormon, he said that you can't really understand the pull of, say, heavy metal music and its satanic imagery unless you were raised in a fundamentalist community where the devil was the only real rebel that you knew. Do you have similar feelings to that?
That's interesting. Well, the devil was not the only rebel I knew. I mean, because it was a horribly gossipy town, and there were constant, I mean, there's no way you can live up to those standards of not drinking, not smoking, not falling in love with the wrong person, not having sex, you know. Everyone was a rebel in that sense, because no one was, there were very few people who were cutting the mustard that way, and they were, to me, they were all women, you know. That's why I always had this dream that I would know the rapture came because all the women would be gone, because all the horrible men and ill-behaved children would be left behind. I guess I still have, I do see the world kind of in good versus evil terms. And I, even though I don't believe in that devil anymore, I am kind of always looking for them. And also, one thing I learned after I got out of there and after I started completely questioning those beliefs is that true evil often has a pretty face. And I think that actually definitely comes from the whole Antichrist theory. You know, they always told us the Antichrist is probably going to be blonde and handsome and nice and funny and smart and sweet, and to always look behind that face to see what's going on. And I mean, in terms of heavy metal, I guess they aren't heavy metal, but the big demons of my 70s childhood there were Kiss, and they were the Antichrist. You know, they were supposed to be knights in Satan's service, and we had to pray against them. I think they were the only people we ever prayed against. You know, we were constantly praying for, but they were just seemed they were deemed irredeemable, and we were to stay away from them, and I was just scared to death of them. And you know, meanwhile, my mom is letting me listen to, like, Loretta Lynn's The Pill, you know, which is, I guess, fine because it was country music, but it was a song about, you know, putting on the hot pants because now she's got birth control. And then years later in college, I had a roommate who was an old K Kiss kid, and I heard Kiss for the first time, you know, like that love song, Beth, and I thought, this was the problem, you know, it's just totally candy rock and way more acceptable than some of those sexy country songs I was allowed to listen to.
See, you were praying against Kiss without even ever having heard them?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
I think you left organized religion at about age 16. Did you feel when you left, it left any kind of gap in your life that you needed to replace with something else?
Oh, it was just a hole that's still there. I mean, I guess it's a rarer and rarer experience as the world becomes more secularized, but it was, I think I'm still getting over it because I always had little doubts, even as a little kid, because a lot of the things don't make sense, you know, especially if you read the Bible. Partly, I always had problems because I'm so gullible. I believed everything. I couldn't understand how you could be a Christian and be a racist because Jesus said, love everybody and preach to the whores. Or I remember in my mom's ladies' prayer meeting, we had to hold hands in a circle and pray for the local bar to be shut down, the Little Oklahoma bar. But I remember, like, thinking, didn't Jesus turn water into wine? You know, I just didn't understand any of that. So I always had little nagging doubts, but I talked to God constantly, I guess, until I was 16. And I was therefore never lonely. I mean, I was always kind of a loner, but I always felt like I had someone to talk to. And then once I lost that, it was a few years before I kind of got used to just thinking to myself instead of talking to the supreme being or something.
So there was a kind of vacuum.
I guess.
What else had to change when your religion, when your faith and your religion ended?
Well, you have to figure out how to be good without having hell hanging over your head.
Uh-huh.
And in a way, it's harder, I think, to figure out how to be a moral person when you don't have a book telling you how to be moral. And so that was an interesting question. This all, of course, kind of happened simultaneously with the existentialism chapter or the existentialism unit in high school English class.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of those teen angst books I was reading then too, you know, things like The Stranger by Camus or something, asked those sort of questions. How can there be morality in the absence of God? And basically, it eventually occurred to me that, you know, things like the Ten Commandments it's a very good idea. Like, those are good rules, and I believe in them. And I don't have to believe in impending doom to decide not to sleep with someone else's husband, you know.
Sarah Vowell speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. Her new book, Assassination Vacation, has just been published.